Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein, senior editor at First Things Magazine, speaking today with Dana Gioia, noted poet and essayist, translator, and librettist. He is currently the Judge Whitney Professor of Poetry and Public Culture at the University of Southern California, before that serving as chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts from 2002 to 2009. He's written four volumes of poetry, most recently, Interrogations at Noon and Pity the Beautiful. He has also written two volumes of essays, Can Poetry Matter and Disappearing Ink. All of his works you can find at the website danagioia.net. Gioia may be best known to our audience for his essay in First Things last year entitled The Catholic Writer Today. The essay began with a dismaying regret that while 50 years ago one could scan the American literary scene and find Catholicism and Catholic writers playing a formative role, today, that role has much diminished. As Gioia put it, the religion of one quarter of the U.S. population has retreated to the point of invisibility in the fine arts. As you may imagine, the essay sparked heated responses both among First Things readers and in the literary world. Last month, USC, the Institute for Advanced Catholic Studies, hosted a conference on the topic entitled The Future of Catholic Literary Imagination. And it included some of the leading Catholic writers and critics in America. Today, we're going to continue the discussion. But first, one thing. I saw Dana Gioia deliver a poetry reading at University of Georgia in 2001, the first time I really met him. And one thing that stood out was that he read poems written by others, not just by himself. In that spirit, and to give listeners an idea of his verse, let me recite the first poem in the recent volume, Pity the Beautiful. This is called The Present. The present that you gave me months ago is still unopened by our bed, sealed in its rich blue paper and bright bow. I've even left the card unread and kept the ribbon knotted tight. Why needlessly unfold and bring to light the elegant contrivances that hide the costly secret waiting still inside? So, Dana, can you begin by telling us what motivated you to write the essay in the first place?
Well, I'm sure there's a great many things that motivated it, but at the center was my sense as an American Catholic writer who had inherited a great literary and cultural tradition. I mean, it goes from Dante and Michelangelo to Gerard Manley Hopkins and Mozart, that in my lifetime, this tradition had pretty much disappeared as a living thing in the United States of America. You know, there was almost no vital new Catholic culture. You know, you didn't see Catholic writers, Catholic painters, Catholic musicians. And I felt that this was a great impoverishment, both for the church, you know, who loses its ability to express its vision in art, and also a loss even for secular culture, because culture is a conversation, and when religion and the transcendent leaves that conversation, I think the conversation becomes poorer.
Do you have any broad diagnosis? I mean, this is a huge question, obviously, for why that happened, because one of the things that you show in your essay is if you go back to 1960, the number of writers, famous writers, writers who still appear on college syllabi in English classes all the time, the number of them listed as Catholic in some fashion, not always good Catholics, some bad Catholics or lapsed Catholics in there, but those who could be identified as having some Catholic identities, some Catholic themes and approaches to reality and life in their works. It's an extraordinary group. What happened? Why did that deteriorate so much?
Well, you know, it's usually major cultural changes happen for more than one reason. I think the first thing you have to do is to admit that it did happen. You know, and it's just exactly as you said. If you go back to 1960 and you just asked somebody who wasn't a Catholic, list, you know, the 100 most important writers in America, you know, probably 20 of them would have been Catholic. Flannery O'Connor, Walker Percy, you know, John Berryman, Robert Lowell, you know, William Everson, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. J.F. Powers, they were published in The New Yorker. They were given literary prizes. you know, et cetera, et cetera. If you did it today, you ask this, you know, the similar critic, give 100, you might not find any Catholics on that list. Or if you did, you wouldn't know they were Catholics, you know, because they sort of, you know, keep their religion on the down low. So let's just admit it happened. There's one editor, Greg Wolf, who edits Image, who is in denial that it happens. He says, well, this is the narrative of decline. It's not a narrative of decline. It's just common sense noticing what has changed. So you got to admit that in some ways it happened. Now, that doesn't mean that it was all, you know, rainbows and unicorns, 50, 60 years ago, and that it's all terrible, awful things now. It's just that the culture has changed, and Catholicism's place in that culture has changed. You just got, you know, anybody who is a more or less an accurate observer will notice that. Now, why did it change? Well, I think there's a couple of things. First of all, you know, I'm always for, you know, big on, you know, blaming the victim, you know. And so let's blame the Catholics, first of all. And, you know, I'm 64, you know, immigrant family, you know, in an immigrant neighborhood. And a tremendous number of people in my generation, as they grew up, you know, went to Ivy League schools, got graduate degrees, became very prosperous, you know, left the church. You know, somehow the church, you know, the Catholic church, that's what the immigrant church, you know, they either stopped going to church or, you know, I know a number of Italians that became Episcopals because it's a, you know, it was a it's a fancier, more upscale, you know, faith. So first of all, it's the assimilation of American Catholics, especially educated American Catholics. Secondly, it's let's blame the victim. The Catholic Church in America, the U.S. Catholic Church, to which I belong, you know, to which I'm loyal and admire, is so busy with so many things that it has neither time nor taste for culture. Most priests, you know, don't do a very good job about the music in their church. Most new churches that have been built in the last 60 years are appalling works of architecture. I mean, some of the local churches here, just to walk in the door is penance for my sins. You know, and so you have the church has become disengaged in from culture. Then finally, the secular culture has grown anti-Christian. So let's blame the victimizers now. You know, the secular culture has become anti-Christian, anti-Catholic. And so when you're under attack, when your culture is under attack, and the, you know, the Catholics and the clergy don't defend or foster it, it's not surprising that it vanishes. Now, you know, maybe, you know, so there's other reasons too, but I think it's those three. And so we have a culture now that's almost entirely secular and increasingly anti-Christian, anti-Catholic.
And when we set it in light of the list that you compile in your essay, you say these writers back in 1960, these writers were prominent across the literary world. They included established fiction writers, Flannery O'Connor, Catherine Ann Porter, Walker Percy, J.F. Powers, Ernest Hemingway, Paul Horgan, Jack Kerouac, Julian Green, and so on. Actually, I was very interested to see that you looked at some genre writers like science fiction and detective writers. You mentioned Anthony Boucher, Donald Westlake. I actually love Donald Westlake's novels. The Dortmund novels and the Parker novels are wonderful. Miller,
August Duluth, who is the you know, the kind of the heir in some ways to H.P. Lovecraft, Walter M. Miller, this great science fiction writer that wrote A Canticle for Leibowitz, which is one of the great Catholic American novels. It won the Hugo. You know, it was a pretty rich culture any way you looked at it.
Let me list the poets as well who had a strong Catholic presence. Alan Tate, Robert Lowell, Robert Fitzgerald, Kenneth Rexroth, John Berryman, Elizabeth Gardner, Phyllis McGinley, Claude McKay, and more.
William Everson, who became Brother Antoninus, a Dominican lay brother. You know, so you even had, you know, somebody, you know, people giving poetry readings in Dominican robes.
And that this was not unusual. It wouldn't be regarded as strange.
Catholicism was just one of the expected and important strains of literature. You know, it was not a, you know, this was simply, I think even people that didn't like Catholics just assumed this is one of the flavors that literature came in.
At the conference last week in USC, and we'll talk about the conference in the latter part of our discussion, there was several writers there, and you could see a little bit of discomfort with the idea that any particular kind of cultural or religious identity, or at least maybe I should say any identity that doesn't have the political traction today, they resisted being absorbed or fully assimilated to that. And one thing that I would offer in return is what you say about what you mean by the Catholic writer. And I'm going to read this. Catholic literature is rarely pious. In ways that sometimes trouble or puzzle both Protestant and secular readers, Catholic writing tends to be comic, rowdy, rude, and even violent. Catholics generally prefer to write about sinners rather than saints. It is not only that sinners generally make more interesting protagonists. Their failings also more vividly demonstrate humanity's fallen state. John Kennedy Toole's A Confederacy of Dunces, for example, presents a huge cast of characters, lost souls or reprobates all, who, pursuing their assorted vices and delusions, hilariously stumble toward grace and provisional redemption. I think that qualifier.
Exactly. I mean, some people, when you say Catholic literature, they think that I'm talking about people who write poems about the guardian angels and the Virgin Mary. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about if you're a believing Catholic, if you're a faithful Catholic, if you're raised and educated, you know, in Catholicism, it affects the way you see everything in the world. This confuses a lot of secular people because a lot of Catholics, you know, are to the right on one issue and to the left on the other issue. And they say, well, how can you be that? You got to be one or the other. No, it's Catholicism, you know, believes in certain values. And I think a real Catholic doesn't care where those values, you know, fall on the political spectrum. You know, you have an obligation to the poor. You know, you have an obligation to life. And so anyway, what I'm talking about, you know, is that. I mean, remember, one of the greatest Catholic writers who ever lived is Geoffrey Chaucer. You know, who has a religious tale next to it, an obscene tale in the Canterbury Tales, and it's all part of Chaucer's worldview. So what I'm talking about is basically not religious writing, not devotional writing, but I'm talking about great fiction, poetry, to a certain degree theater, although there's very little Catholic theater anywhere in the world right now, from what I can tell, and how it portrays the imagination.
In other words, great literature never merely advocates doctrine.
Yeah, Mark, when you're reading a short story or a novel, the people in it either feel real or they don't. You know, if the people in the novel are saying, you know, represent little ideas and moral points of view, you know, it's not really literature. It's something else. What art does is embody reality, not in ideas, not in concepts, but in stories, in images that resist simplification. Now, it is impossible for a Catholic or a Christian to reject literature. It is impossible. Why? Because most of the Bible's prophetic books are written as poetry. When Jesus spoke to the multitudes, he didn't, for the most part, give moral rules. He told stories. He told the parables. Occasionally, he gave poems like the Beatitudes. So if God chose to speak to humanity through poetry and stories, how can we say that this is not a natural and powerful way in which truth to be embodied? And in fact, you can take some of Christ's parables, most of them, in fact, remove them entirely from any religious context, And they're still powerful stories. They're about fathers and sons. They're about brothers. They're about masters and servants. They resonate because the story has an independent life that, you know, that a great story has a meaning in excess of every interpretation you can put upon it. And it's very, very powerful. And so what I'm looking for in the revival of Catholic literature are the people that are the great poets, the great storytellers, whose work, they can read the work to an audience that's one half religious and one half atheists, and both sides of the audience feel the impact of the story. That's where Catholic literature has power. So the atheist goes, well, you know, I don't understand this, I don't like it, but I can see what it's about now. I can feel what it's about now. And when the church loses that ability, I mean, I know, see, Catholics, my wife is in RCIA now. She's my wife is a saint. I don't know, there's no other way of putting it. She's just a very learned, and she's in the RCIA. And I mean, anybody who's been through RCIA will know that, you know, and it's not a great experience. You know, just give lots and lots and lots of rules. I don't know anybody who's come to the church because they want lots of rules. I don't know many people who have been argued into Catholicism. Somebody just arguing all the time. People I know who have become Catholics, it's because they were in a church, in an Episcopal church, and somebody played Mozart's C minor mass. And it took them to a place, and they said, what was the vision that created this experience I've had, and they've sought it out? Or they've been in France, and they've walked into Chartres, and they say, whatever aspect of humanity created this is where I want to go. Or it's, you're in nature, and you just sort of say, I can feel the presence of the divine in this thing. We experience faith experientially. You know, there are probably a few people that argue and reason their way to faith, but it's most of the times it's a mysterious process. It happens, and the person doesn't know why it happened. What does this mean? And in fact, so when they do the theology and the apologetics and things like that, it's to figure out and explain what has already happened. I would maintain that this experiential knowledge of the divine that changes lives originates in many ways. I mean, it originates sometimes by just meeting a person who's sort of saint-like, but it also it comes from the experience of great Catholic art.
Church architecture works the same way too, doesn't it?
Yeah, in a way of saying it is that you go into this space and you realize that there's something overpoweringly valuable that's occurring here that's not occurring in the other parts of your life. Right. You know, and what you, the more perfunctory you make that experience, you know, of going, I mean, you know, some, you know, when a, you know, the church doesn't look much different than a, you know, a Grange Hall or a Lions Club, you know, it just seems like, well, this is just more of what goes on out there. Yeah, in a funny way, if being a Catholic can be reduced to one belief, everything else comes out of this, is that 2,000 years ago, eternity entered time. The temporal world and the eternal world crossed at the birth, during the life of Christ, and that what we have in the sacraments, what we have in the faith, is a commemoration of this moment where eternity and time met, and these sacraments, and by extension, the sacramentals, the art, the beauty, puts us in touch with another realm of the world that exists around us called eternity, called the divine, called God. And, you know, the more perfunctory, secular, ordinary we make our liturgy, our architecture, you know, or the fact if we take art and say, look, you know, We're Catholics. We're too busy. You know, we have to feed the hungry. We have to, you know, fight for social justice. You know, we have to, give kids their first communion, all these very necessary tasks. If we say, well, because of that, we have no time. No time at all for the art. Let's leave the art to the secular people. You know, they do it better than us, and what we have, that's why we have the culture that we have, you know. And, the appalling, violent, crude, cruel, exploitative, often obscene culture that's around us. Now, you know, and every Catholic I know complains about it. But the fact is that, you know, that it wasn't always so. It didn't and doesn't need to be so. And we still, and this brings us to the USA Conference, there are still some very important writers who are Catholic in this country. And they're, you know, they're people that are tremendous novelists and poets, you know, and they think deeply about matters of ethics and faith and spirituality. And so I just felt that, you know, that we needed to create a gathering for these people. And, you know, and the gathering had a couple of different objectives. I mean, the first was simply to bring people together. And we brought about, you know, not, we had about 200 high school students one day that we created classes for, but we had about, I think, 210 writers and scholars and teachers from 150 institutions, universities, colleges, seminaries around the country, bring them together just so that they, in a sense, see what the best of Catholic letters looks like now. Secondly, we had a conversation among each other for 3 days with these panels and these talks and the meals and things like that. Now you can have we used to, when I was a kid, I was raised in this really tight family, and every Sunday we would go next door to my aunt and uncles, where my grandparents were there, and my mother, who was very Catholic, would argue with my uncle, who was an atheist, and they would just they loved arguing. Nothing made them happier than to argue with each other. And there's one kind of argument you have with somebody who doesn't believe what you do, but there's another kind of conversation you have among your own tribe. And so I wanted, you know, bring people together. I wanted to create this conversation among people who cared about writing, who cared about Catholicism, and often are very marginal and alone in their daily lives. They're the only Catholic in the faculty. And create that conversation. And then finally, the third thing I wanted to do was to help rebuild an active, talented community of Catholic artists. And I feel we did all three. The Institute of Advanced Catholic Studies at USC, sponsored this. And I think everybody was astonished by the success. We literally could not have fit in any more people. We were bulging, bursting at the seams. And so I felt very much that the most important thing that happened at USC, at this conference on the future of the Catholic literary imagination, happened in the moment, in the mind, in the hearts, in the actions of the people around. And if they left the conference with this vivid memory of having spent, for the first time in their lives maybe, 3 days with people who value the same things that they did, that is the legacy of the conference, not a transcript. Yeah, I remember, I can't remember who it was. I was reading once the works of, I mean, I did a lot, I, you know, 20, 30 years ago, I got fascinated by monasticism, and I read lots and lots of, you know, books by various monks. And there was one saint, monastic saint, who said something, and I said yes, and he said that the company of your fellows in Christ should be a joy and a refreshment. And I'm sorry, I can't remember which of our many distinguished monastic saints said this, but I wanted the conference to be a joy and a refreshment.
Let me ask one final question, Dana. Do you see in the publishing world any readiness, openness, any new attitude toward Christian and especially Catholic writing?
Well, you know, I think the best writing will get published. I mean, Alice McDermott, you know, who would have joined us at the conference, but her mother died. Alice McDermott is a very Catholic writer, and her novels are well received. Now, she sets them in the past, which I think is interesting, like the 50s and the 40s, the 50s and 60s. And so maybe the secular audience is, you know, willing to believe that, you know, that, really, you know, that this mattered back then. But she's, you know, very successful. Ron Hanson is a successful novelist. I don't think that, that either of those people get their full due. I mean, I think they're both major novelists. But I think in general, I don't believe secular publishers believe any longer that there's much of a Catholic niche. The Catholic niche that exists is covered by, you know, very fine Catholic presses, you know, Image and things like this, Ignatian. So I think there's an opportunity to have more Catholic presence in the mainstream. But the fact is, I mean, this is the most important thing. And this is at one point I interrupted the conversation, you know, in LA. I was probably slightly rude because they're saying, well, why don't this and why doesn't the church do this and why don't Catholic publishers do this? And I said, if you want this, do it yourself. And if you want a good Catholic magazine, help find, you know, create one or join one and make it better, you know, create a press. We had a remarkable young man there named Joshua Wren, just started teaching at the University of Mary. And he created, when he was unemployed, an unemployed PhD with two small kids, he now has three, you know, he created a Catholic literary press by sheer force of will and faith. And that's how we're going to change the culture. So I'm very confident that we can make things better. It's going to come from the laity. It's going to come from artists and intellectuals. And it's going to require, as most worthy human activities do, a lot of work.